KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Wear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. As I mentioned, we've had a flare-up of the Woolsey Fire in the area of Lake Sherwood. Some of that area around Westlake Village, Lake Sherwood, people have been coming back into this area, but the flare-up is moving dramatically fast. Fortunately, on TV, it looked like it was moving away from the lake, and water-dropping helicopters were getting a lot of water on it, just pumping out of Lake Sherwood. But with us, Woolsey Fire Public Information Officer. His regular day job is as fire captain with the Los Angeles Fire Department, Eric Scott. Captain, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it very much.
You're welcome, Larry.
So let's start, first of all, with this flare-up. It looks dramatic on television. What can you tell us?
You're right. We did immediately get a lot of intelligence in reference to the large column of smoke that's very visible from a lot of the surrounding communities in Thousand Oaks and Westlake and Newberry Park. And that started around 9:15 this morning. It was a 50-plus acre spot fire. It may have grown to 100 acres at this point. But the good news is we did immediately send nearby ground and air resources, and they're getting a good handle on it. And we will provide any additional information for evacuation if necessary.
I was hearing that red flag warning for the high winds might be extended. We thought we were going to be out of the woods, so to speak,
right,
by the end of today. Have you gotten an update on the wind forecast?
You're right, Larry. Originally, we thought they would end on Tuesday, but it looks like our Santa Ana winds are being a bit stubborn, and we likely will have the red flag continued until Wednesday night. But we did get a little lull in the wind 2 days ago. That certainly helped with our containment. So the latest as of today is the containment has got up to 35% on this 96,000-acre brush fire.
All right. So that's the good news. Now, some communities, people are able to go back in. Can you take us through where it's safe for people to return?
You know, our friends at local law enforcement share the lead in evacuations and repopulation back into those areas. That has been a very systematic process that's been going on now 6 days into the firefight. The best way to get the information would be go to vcemergency.com, or you could stay tuned to your local fire stations and fire departments' Twitter handles, and we'll continue to repopulate those areas. The newest one was last night. If you look at the whole big burn footprint of the Woolsey Fire, would be the northeast portion, so that involved West Hills and portions of Bell Canyon.
All right. And I saw Hidden Hills fully reopening west of Valley Circle. So you've got a number of the Los Angeles city areas where people are going back. So that's certainly good news. One of the concerns I know in some of these areas is about downed power lines and that it's not safe to go back in until repair crews can deal with the lines, even if power isn't flowing through those lines. Do you have any sense of what we're looking at timeline to get that thoroughly inspected?
The downed power lines are throughout the 96,000 acres, so that involves multiple jurisdictional areas. But they're working very hard to get the power back on it. But it's important for your listeners to remember that if they see any downed power lines, to view them as potentially energized and lethal. In addition to that, when you have downed power, you have stoplights that may stop functioning. So it's important for everyone when they come across those and they are out there to view that as a four-way stop.
All right. We're talking with Captain Eric Scott, Public Information Officer for the Woolsey Fire. He's with the Los Angeles City Fire Department and joining us to talk about the very latest developments. As mentioned, this flare-up of the fire, the good news is it appears to be moving very quickly, but away from populated areas, and that's a relief. We'll take whatever positive news we can get. And they're getting so much water on it so quickly that even with the high winds, looks like some good news to report with this flare-up near Carlisle Canyon, Lake Sherwood, Boney Mountain areas there. We're talking about the future of the fire, and at this point, we're still hoping to find out when Malibu residents might be able to move in. My understanding at this point, Captain, is that there's still no time definite on when Malibu residents can go back in.
Well, Malibu portion of the Woolsey Fire footprint is one of the most active. It was one of the most recently burned through the six-day process. Therefore, you have multiple structures throughout that area that are smoldering. The Santa Anta winds then really spark those back up. So we have to be very careful letting people to come back into those areas. And it's important, too, to remember that when these structures have been smoldering and burning over a long time period, they have the potential for collapse. So do the trees. The trees throughout there have been smoldering. Some of them are starting to fall. So there's multiple challenges for firefighters as well as the public that lives in that area. And you did mention a great point earlier, Larry, about the strategic water drops that have been happening, in particular to that new current flare-up on everyone is seeing. But right now we have 15 air tankers and 20 helicopters that were able to come out at the height of the fire. So they have dropped, to give a little perspective, 1.5 million gallons of water and nearly 400,000 gallons of fire retardant.
Wow. Astounding. And we're seeing the ability of those drops, even with wind-pushed fire like this flare-up, and be able to deal with that. And I'm impressed. You know, yesterday we had the Rocky Peak fire, that started right along the 118 freeway there. They closed it in both directions for a while. And again, they were able to get on that so fast. So it seems like this is really the game plan today, right? Wherever embers start something up or wherever smoldering reignites is just to jump on it ASAP.
Absolutely. And when we have a large fire of this size, we break it up very organizationally into different divisions, and we have a hierarchy and a chain of command. So we have people continually surveying that area. We have boots on the ground that are still attacking any hot spots, that are handling any smoldering structures. So as soon as a new fire pops up, which will continue to happen while we have winds and active flame, we're getting on it very fast and quick. But if you look at, if we step back and look at this on a whole state region, the three biggest fires right now in the state, first is the Woolsey Fire. Also, simultaneously when that broke out was the Hill Fire.
Yeah.
And up north, you got the Butte Fire. So those are your three biggest. You have nearly 9,000 firefighters that have come from all over to fight those fires. So they've really been doing an outstanding job around the clock over the last 6 days to ensure that we save life and property.
Captain Eric Scott, thank you so much. Appreciate your joining us again today. Thank you. Woolsey Fire Public Information Officer, now with us, the mayor of Malibu, Rick Mullen. Mayor Mullen, thank you for being with us, and we extend our greatest concerns, condolences to your residents who've lost their homes. This has been such a traumatic time for residents of your city. Please share with us the latest that you want folks to know about Malibu.
Well, you just heard it from the public information officer. Because of the winds that are still here and because there are still some potential for, some of those embers and everything burning some of the areas that have not been burned yet, it's not quite safe for everybody to come in. But for everyone who's out there, I know that who's outside of the city, I know that their biggest priority is they want to get in, and they want to get in now to go through, check their home if it made it, and to check the area of what was their home and see if they can find anything if they unfortunately lost their home. So it's my desire to get people in as quickly as possible, commensurate with safety and the overall operational plan. It's just not quite there yet. I had hoped that everything could be calm. And what they are doing is they're phasing it in to places that, you know, on the north side of the 101, they're going to be able to let people back into some of those areas, and then they will move it down as into the areas as they become safer. It's just quite safe enough for people to come in. I know they all want to get back in, and I feel for them. I know there's been devastating losses, but that's the situation as it is right now.
Mayor Mullen, thanks very much, and we'll share with listeners about the city meeting tonight at Santa Monica High School and let people know about that as well. I assume that's still on, Mayor?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Appreciate you passing that word along. It is at 7 p.m. at Town Hall meeting, and we'll be able to get a lot of information out. There still is. People can still go up the city's website, and everything related to information that we're trying to pass out will go through that. Also, the city of Malibu's normal number, 310-456-2489, gets forwarded to the EOC, the city's EOC, which is in Santa Monica. So go up the city's website to get that information. Attend the town hall meeting tonight at 7 p.m. in Santa Monica, and you'll be able to get all the latest information.
Thank you so much. That's Mayor Rick Mullen, City of Malibu. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. That meeting tonight, 7 o'clock, Santa Monica High's Barnum Hall. And you can park close to Samo High at the Civic Center parking lot that's nearby. There's free parking that's available to attend what I'm sure is going to be a jam-packed meeting tonight at 7 o'clock. Such pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I assure you we are on top of the very latest developments in the Woolsey fire. So that flare-up, which the airborne water drops are helping to curtail, we'll keep you updated on that. They brought in the DC-10, by the way, which can do just massive amounts of fire retardant on that flare-up in the area of Lake Sherwood. We'll keep you up to date on that. But we have very important political news that continues as the counts are on in Georgia, Florida. They're recounting both the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. Historic there with the mandatory recount when the margin is so razor thin. And of course, we still have House seats that are undecided right here in Southern California. Joining us is NPR's politics editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, good to have you with us again.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So let's start, first of all, by looking right here in Southern California. We continue to have two extraordinarily close House races. Yesterday, the Associated Press calling the 48th District for Democrat Harley Ruda over Dana Rohrabacher, the 30-year incumbent. But in the 45th District, Republican incumbent Mimi Walters has just a 2,000-vote lead on Democratic challenger Katie Porter. And then 39th District, Republican Young Kim has just a 2,400-vote lead on Democrat Gil Cisneros. Still too close to call those races.
Absolutely. And right now, you know, Democrats have picked up 32 seats as a net for taking over Congress. That's the largest pickup for Democrats in the post-Watergate era there in midterms. You remember in 2006, Democrats, when they kind of were swept into the House again, they only picked up 30 seats that year. And that was when the Iraq Civil War was kind of spiraling out of control and there were all these scandal seats up. And, you know, I've heard from a lot of liberals and progressives who felt like they didn't have a great night on Tuesday. I'm here to tell you they should really be celebrating because, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to wind up being 36, maybe 37 seat net gain. That's a lot of seats. And there was really an uprising in the suburbs in particular, like Orange County, but in places outside of Kansas City, outside of Houston, Atlanta, Philadelphia, where really independents and women, the story that we'd been been hearing about all throughout the lead up to the campaign really did come to fruition. And, there were some marquee races that Democrats didn't win or aren't winning at this point, but they should really be happy taking back the House.
Well, and some of these were aided by Republican retirements in some of those races because they saw the writing on the wall, like Darrell Issa's district in Southern California. He knew the odds of him retaining that seat were slim, so he just retired. That was a lot of those. But in some of the cases, there were other factors involved. That seemed to aid these numbers, didn't it, Domenico?
Sure thing. And, the thing is, at the beginning of any cycle, if you're an incumbent, you know what your incumbency reelection rate is. Usually an incumbent can do fairly well, but they'd also don't want to put themselves at risk. They'd rather kind of some of them cash out, take other kinds of jobs, move on with their lives rather than have to face a tough reelection bid, raise a lot of money, spend a lot of money, and maybe not even win. So, that itself put Republicans on their back foot. And then once there's all those open seats, then it makes it very difficult. I mean, leading into Election Day, I had something like 80 seats that were competitive to potentially competitive that Democrats were targeting. On the Republican side, they were only targeting really about 8 seats.
Yeah, so the you can see what the path was for Democrats with that. Now, on the Senate side, Kyrsten Sinema defeated Martha McSally in that race for Jeff Flake's seat as he didn't seek reelection. So the first time that we've had a Democratic senator in Arizona in quite a few years.
That's right, dating back to the 1980s, and it's the first time that Democrats have won an open Senate race in Arizona since the 1970s. So certainly goes back a long way, and that could be a sign of changing times. President Trump wound up winning Arizona in 2016, but only by about 4 points. That's not very much for a state that had been fairly Republican for a very long time. But, changing demographics in the state, and then when you combine what's happened in the suburban districts and with women in particular, then it makes a state like Arizona competitive, not just for the Senate race, where now Democrats have won, but also potentially for 2020. You saw maybe Beto O'Rourke didn't win in Texas, but certainly raised the floor for a lot of House candidates. He only lost by 3 points in Texas, giving Ted Cruz certainly a run for his money. This is not a state that, even though it had been one that had trended Republican for a very long time, not one that was particularly kind to President Trump in 2016. He only won it by about 9 points. So that's another place where Republicans and President Trump are going to have to spend a lot of money, and that's a very expensive, important state. And, the Arizona race is also important to the national landscape because, that means that Republicans net only about 2 seats and Democrats are now in striking distance of taking back the Senate in 2020.
And despite their very contentious debate between McSally and Sinema, Martha McSally with a gracious concession to Kyrsten Sinema, we're not seeing much graciousness in Florida and Georgia. I mean, these have really, in the past several days, Domenico, gotten quite nasty.
Gotten really bitter. And you consider Rick Scott, somebody who spoke out against President Trump, talked about Puerto Rico and how he had visited Puerto Rico several times. That's because the Puerto Rican population in Florida has been growing and he didn't want to alienate that group. But then once the election happened and felt like there was something shady going on there in South Florida in Broward County, without any evidence, decided to say that liberals were trying to steal the election from him, set President Trump off, and he's been tweeting ever since. So, these things, the legitimacy of our elections are really foundational to our democracy. And to see a president and statewide candidates for office not respecting that, I think raises a lot of eyebrows for a lot of people and question, what it does to that institution.
Well, and each party has its narrative in these close races, right? So the Democrats, their narrative is that Republicans are doing everything they can to suppress the vote and try and keep qualified people from being able to have a chance to vote. And then when you get these later votes that tend to skew Democratic coming in the count, then Republicans saying, well, who knows where these votes are coming from? There's fraudulent voting. So it's, it's interesting. Each of them trying to angle with their particular, view of how the elections proceeded.
Yeah, you know, it's easy to be gracious in losing when you lose by a lot. You know, when it's very close and very tight and things are changing, then you start to get anxious and worry that there's something else afoot and something else going on. But it's really interesting because count the vote didn't used to be partisan. You know, count every vote used to be something that all sides could agree on. And that's not what's happening right now. You seem to have Republicans in particular sitting there saying, you know, hey, I was up on election night. Let's put this thing away. We don't need to count all of the vote again. And, you know, Florida is a place having three statewide recounts right now. That is expensive. It is mandated by state law, but it is the first time in its history that it's had to have that many in one cycle, and it's we're talking about millions of votes.
So Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia, is hoping that, you know, with the remaining votes to be counted, maybe she can force a runoff if Brian Kemp isn't able to get to the 50% threshold. The odds look like they're against her at this point, but it's still possible. We've seen, particularly with the heavy Democratic count of the later votes, we've seen some dramatic moves.
Yeah, and I think there's already lawsuits when it comes to voter access, and you know, even if Stacey Abrams doesn't pull it off in this election, Georgia is a state that is changing. Demographically, it has changed enormously over the last 20 years, and it's a place where national Democrats think it could become a battleground state in presidential elections. And you know, when it comes to these voter access, voter suppression, things that Democrats are looking at in states like that and other places in the South in particular, you know, this is something on principle that a lot of civil rights groups want to push forward with, even if Abrams doesn't wind up pulling it out in the end.
I wanted to ask you quickly about the leadership of the House. Nancy Pelosi, her profile obviously much higher over the course of the past week. Does it appear she's going to have much opposition for the speaker position?
There is some grumbling with Nancy Pelosi, and you know, there's not everybody is on board. Whether that kind of becomes a bigger problem for her, we're watching that very closely on Capitol Hill. It's certainly one of the big stories heading into 2019. You know, she certainly feels like she deserves a second shot, given that she was the first woman speaker and was very effective as a speaker in helping move President Obama's legislation forward. She's done a lot to help people raise money. There are some within the caucus who believe that the party needs a new face, that she's become too much of a lightning rod. And that certainly played out on election night, where she had an even lower favorability rating than President Trump because of how many millions of dollars have been spent, taking down her image. So it's going to be something to watch. The smart money is probably on her becoming speaker again, but we'll see.
Well, and then we're poised to see Kevin McCarthy of California become the Republican leader. So interesting, both would be from California if that holds. Domenico, thank you so much. Good to talk with you as always.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Domenico Montanaro, politics editor at NPR, joining us with the latest. Coming up momentarily, we switch to California politics, a supermajority for Democrats in the state legislature. But there is a split among the alliances those Democrats have. We'll talk about that in a moment. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking politics. So much focus has been on the midterm congressional elections, but big news here in California as well, as Democrats have taken 2/3 majorities in both houses of the state legislature. But that doesn't, of course, mean all those Democratic legislators are alike. With us to talk about the results from Cal Matters political reporter Laurel Rosenhall and from the Los Angeles Times Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. John, Laurel, thank you both for joining with us. Laurel, let me start with you about the supermajority and what that's going to mean legislatively going into the next session.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. The supermajority, you know, on paper, it gives the Democratic Party an enormous amount of of power. With two-thirds majorities, Democrats can vote on a tax increase without any Republican support. They can change the state's political ethics laws. They can put constitutional amendments on the ballot. And they can approve all kinds of sort of procedural moves within the normal course of business of legislating that they will be able to do unilaterally. In reality, though, there is a lot of variety among the Democrats who serve in Sacramento, and getting them to all agree on a controversial proposal like a tax increase is not a slam dunk.
And so let's talk about the factionalism in Sacramento. What are the varying allegiances of those elected Democrats?
Well, the largest block of Democrats are those that are aligned with labor unions and environmentalists. These are kind of the traditional core supporters of the Democratic Party and strong influences on the Democratic caucuses in the Assembly and the Senate. But we have seen in recent years, as the Republican Party has declined, business groups have really kind of put a lot of money into electing Democrats who they think will be sympathetic to their needs. And so there are a couple of new legislators who are coming into office with the benefit of millions of dollars of support from, for example, oil companies and other large businesses that, you know, frequently clash with Democrats. And so we do have in Sacramento kind of a caucus of moderate Democrats who maybe aren't as aggressive on environmental issues and tend to side more with the oil industry and other business on those issues. Then there's also another dynamic that has to do with technology and tech companies. You might have some Democrats who are sort of more tech friendly on issues that might put them in conflict with labor unions. So there's not a perfect way to define kind of who's the moderate Democrat. But I think what we're going to see in this upcoming session with so many Democrats is that there are going to be those who are more sympathetic to business interests in one area and some who are more sympathetic in other industry sectors.
Laurel, how do we think then the leadership of the state Senate and the Assembly are going to negotiate this? In the recent session, the Senate seems to be actually the more progressive House, which sort of flips longer-term history of the legislature.
Right.
And how do you anticipate that's going to affect the sort of dance leadership has to do?
Well, you know, you can't forget the fact that one of the Democratic legislators was recalled this year, Senator Josh Newman, who represented part of Orange County. And, you know, he was elected in 2016. He voted for a tax increase in 2017, gas tax, which almost every Democrat voted for. He was by no means the swing vote on that issue. There was even one Republican who voted for it. But because he was from a swing district and was sort of politically vulnerable given the electorate in his region, the Republicans went after him and successfully ousted him. So I think that the Senate leadership is sensitive to that, aware that, you know, that basically Republicans are going to be looking for places where they can do recalls and that, you know, pushing for a tax increase is going to be difficult. There's going to be that recall of Josh Newman really spooked a lot of Democrats.
Even though the ballot measure went down to defeat that would have repealed the gas tax increase. Laurel, thanks so much. Appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
Laurel Rosenhall, political reporter for the nonprofit Cal Matters. Also with us, John Myers of the LA Times. John, let's get your thoughts, first of all, on the makeup of the legislature. You know, what do you think are going to be the most interesting storylines there to follow in the upcoming session?
Well, I mean, Larry, I think that the great unknown is the new person in the corner office. Gavin Newsom, who will take office as the 40th governor in January, comes in with a larger number of Democrats. But as Laurel pointed out, and as we've talked about, these are not all the same kind of Democrats in terms of more liberal, more business aligned. So So I think Hal Newsom forges relationships with them. And I really think it's important to point out, too, that you have a legislature now that has collectively more experience than any legislature in a generation. And that's because voters recrafted term limits a few years ago to extend the length of time in any one office for these members of the legislature. They have more seniority to the as compared to the governor-elect versus Jerry Brown, who had 40-plus years of experience. I think there was more deference to Jerry Brown by the legislature. There may not be as much with these Democrats in the legislature to a Governor Newsom. And I think that is probably, first and foremost, the most interesting thing for me to watch going forward.
Yeah, makes sense. We're looking at a super close superintendent of public instruction race where, you know, so much money was poured into this race for, you know, what essentially is a bully pulpit on education as opposed to really having a lot of power. But there, Tony Thurmond, about 3,000 votes ahead of Marshall Tuck. That's incredibly close when you think over 7 million were cast in this race. This going down to the wire.
Yeah, it is. And there are more votes to count. And, you know, it's interesting to me, Larry, that Tony Thurmond, who was the Democrat backed by the teachers union, backed by organized labor, was behind, has been behind since election night from as compared to Marshall Tuck, who is the Democrat who was backed by charter schools. This really is a proxy fight about the future, I think, of charter schools and the power of teachers unions in particular. You're exactly right. The superintendent of public instruction does not have a tremendous amount of actual power. It's more of a symbolic position. But this is a race that the union groups don't want to lose. I don't think they want to give Marshall Tuck the platform to talk about school revamping and charter schools on a state level. And this one's going to be really close. And it's worth pointing out, as I wrote for a story for the newspaper over the weekend, there is no automatic recount in California. There is no close race and we count the ballots over unless someone pays for a recount. And even then, it's not always statewide. So we may be left with a super razor-thin margin by the time it's all over.
Although both the candidates are so well-funded, you'd think, you know, they could come up with the money if they really think they could, the loser, you know, the trailing candidate could flip it. Maybe they'd, you know, invest the money in doing it. Also, just real quickly, Steve Poizner, the former state insurance commissioner, former Republican running as an NPP without party preference, looked like he might take this state insurance commissioner position. But Democrat Ricardo Lara, the state legislator, looks like he's going to take that at this point. He's in the lead. And that's got to be discouraging for some of those Republican minded candidates who might have thought, well, I'll go no party preference. Maybe that'll give me a shot. But anyway, interesting to see that, John Myers, unfold. John, we're out of time, but thank you so much. As always, it's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John Myers, Los Angeles Times, Sacramento Bureau Chief, joining us right here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up at 11 o'clock, we will bring you the live coverage of the latest news briefing on the Woolsey fire.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
I want to thank our media partner, NBC4, for the audio of the news conference we just heard on the Woolsey fire. And, of course, we'll bring you up to date on any developments over the course of the day here on KPCC, not just on Air Talk. Well, Amazon has finally made its choice about where it's going to put a second headquarters, and it's actually going to be numbers 2 and 3. New York City's Long Island City neighborhood in Queens and in Northern Virginia, in Arlington, in the Crystal City area. That's where the two additional headquarters for Amazon are going to be. Joining us to talk about it, Elizabeth Weiss, technology reporter for U.S. USA Today. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
So what sorts of concessions is it thought that Amazon was probably able to wrest from these communities in exchange for putting additional headquarters there?
So a lot of this went on behind closed doors, but we now know that at least New York, they were given about $1.5 billion in incentives. In Virginia, it's looking like it's coming in at about $1 million. It was both at the state and the county and the local level. So the numbers there are a little less clear, but I mean millions and millions of dollars, with of course the presumption that it will pay for itself in jobs and taxes on the people who work there and the services they end up buying. We'll see.
Now, though this is being widely reported, we still don't have official word from Amazon, do we?
No, we do, actually.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Yeah, no, I know. You guys have been busy with fires. they made an announcement this morning, and in fact, they just had a news conference in Arlington, Virginia, and it is in fact set for the Crystal City, which is in Northern Virginia, just across the river from Washington D.C. Though they have renamed it, they're trying to give it new names because it's kind of this interesting amalgam of space. And then in this neighborhood in Queens, in New York, though there's already a fair amount of opposition in New York. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, and is the opposition over any incentives the city offered, or are there concerns about what this is going to mean to, you know, real estate prices and that sort of thing?
I think it would be all of the above.
Okay.
They're upset by the incentives. They're upset by the potential for gentrification and further income inequality. There's a real marked difference between the way the politicians in New York were responding and the politicians in Virginia, who all got up on stage and were talking about how wonderful it was. And then you have New York politicians tweeting that they're going to fight this in the streets. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. There was a lot of speculation that Northern Virginia, the D.C. area, would be a front runner, not just because they were in that you know, finalist list, but the fact that Jeff Bezos, you know, owns the Washington Post, you've got Dulles Airport, you've got the real estate there. New York City wasn't necessarily, I didn't hear that touted as one of the real front runners. What's your theory as to why this Long Island City area of Queens was chosen?
Well, I think when you look at it at its broadest, this whole exercise is all about Amazon getting the best and brightest tech talent it can get. There is a war going on. It's not just in the U.S., it's globally, for the absolute best and brightest, because companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook, Alibaba in China, they, to continue the level of innovation that they are set at now, they have to hire not just the best, but all of the best. I mean, they hire tens of thousands of people across the board every year. And so really what Amazon was looking for is a place where it could hire these people that they would come to, because that's kind of their rate-limiting factor. Not everybody wants to live in Seattle. I'm from Seattle. I love it, but I understand that in February it's rough. And so they were really looking for a place that they knew they could hire people and people would sign on the dotted line and come and work for them there. And while New York will not be as perhaps as welcoming or as thrilled to have them there as some other places, what New York has is this enormous concentration already of tech talent, and it's a global city that, you know, if you try and hire somebody from London or Paris or Germany or coming out of MIT and you say, hey, you want to come and live in New York City and we'll pay you enough that you can have a reasonable apartment, they're much more likely to go there than if you said, hey, we're going to put it in, you know, Omaha, Nebraska, a lovely town, but not those folks.
But tougher to recruit people. You've also got two airports there. LaGuardia is so close, and JFK there. You know, similarly in this Crystal City area of Virginia with Reagan National and Dulles. So that also, I assume that's an important thing to them too, that they wanted large airports nearby.
Amazon wanted large airports nearby, and also Amazon's hiring this millennial generation of workers who are very different than their parents. They, when they get that first great job, their first thought isn't, oh boy, I'm going to move to the suburbs and buy a house with a lawn. They want to live in a city. They don't necessarily want to have to own a car. And so Amazon also chose two places that have very strong urban culture. They have a strong and fun arts nightlife. They have good, well, they have for the United States, they have excellent mass transit infrastructure, though I think both are going to need to be built out a bit. But that, you know, that's also part of luring these people in. I mean, Microsoft is out, you know, in the suburbs outside of Seattle, and it's harder for them to get this new generation of workers to go there because they want to live in the cities.
Yeah. Elizabeth, anything else to add about this major announcement before we let you go?
I think Amazon, it was surprising and yet not surprising that they decided, instead of doing just one second headquarters, which was kind of their original statement, that they split it in two. Having covered Amazon for a number of years, I will say that they're really pragmatic. And when they look at the facts, they say, this wasn't working. Let's do something else. And I'm sure they were getting a lot of feedback and pushback in Seattle because they were just bringing too much disruption to the city. And I know that some of the cities that they were looking at said, you know, we're just not sure we can handle an influx of 50,000 white-collar workers making $150,000 a year. And so Amazon said, this isn't going to work. What can we do differently? And then they're not afraid to pivot. And I think it's probably going to go better for them than if they just chose one place.
Yeah, Elizabeth, disruption in the negative sense, not in the sense it's often used in the tech sector. Elizabeth Weiss, USA Today, thank you so much. Appreciate your talking with us.
You're so welcome. Thanks.
Technology reporter with USA Today, who's been closely following the search for Amazon's second headquarters, and now we know there'll be two second headquarters in Northern Virginia, in the D.C. Area, and also in New York City's Queens neighborhood, Long Island City. With us, Bill Allen, CEO of the L.A. Economic Development Corporation. He's going to be joining us momentarily. They submitted the bid for Los Angeles to get the second Amazon headquarters. We're going to talk with him. I'm sure he's disappointed about it, but talk a bit about what was involved in making the bid, and we'll talk with economist Chris Thornburg of Beacon Economics. Also get Chris weighing in on this and see what he thinks about Amazon's choices for the D.C. area and NYC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Just to let you know the good news at this point, it appears that flare-up near Lake Sherwood in an offshoot of the Woolsey fire, that they've got a good handle on that. So that's a real positive as we bring you up to date on a continuing basis on the Woolsey fire here in Southern California. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Thank you for all the ways in which you support us here. It means so much to us, and I appreciate your kind words of support for the coverage we bring you as well. Right now, we're talking about Amazon's announcement that it is creating a second and third headquarters in Northern Virginia, right across the Potomac from D.C., and on in Queens, Long Island City, in New York. Those are the two headquarters sites that have been announced. With me, Bill Allen, CEO of the L.A. Economic Development Corporation, which submitted the bid on behalf of Los Angeles. Bill, thank you for being with us. First of all, you have to be disappointed that L.A. was not chosen.
Well, of course, we would have loved to see L.A. as a site for this HQ2. process was a very positive one in which I believe we learned a lot about our market, and I know the Amazon site selection team learned a lot about our market, particularly as it relates to the talent pool and the talent development pipeline here. If you look at the two markets that they have selected, the Washington, D.C. metro area and the New York metro area, those produce more computer programming graduates than any other metropolitan regions in the country. Third in that list is Los Angeles. And the Amazon folks who were here were well aware of the creative talent here that they are utilizing to great effect at Amazon Studios and Amazon Games and other creative aspects of their business. But I think they became much more aware of the breadth and depth of the tech talent available here in the LA region. And as a result, I think there will be more to come from Amazon in this region.
All right. Can you reveal now what was in the bid to Amazon? Because I know it was confidential for the terms when you made it. Now that LA has been eliminated, can you share what we offered?
I wish I could. These confidentiality agreements extend beyond even the announcement date, and that's good for the regions as well as for Amazon because it allows us to be discreet about what was offered to a particular project so it doesn't become the floor for some other project's bidding. What I can share with you is that the state, particularly Governor Brown's office, the county, particularly our supervisors, initiated by Mark Ridley Thomas, commissioning us to do this proposal, and our cities who had sites that included, of course, the city of LA and many other cities here, all contributed to the process of incentives, some of which were financial, some of which were expediting services, some of which were infrastructure necessary to meet all of Amazon's needs. I would say it was a very responsible proposal. It was nothing on the order of what you heard from certain cities that were offering $5, 7, and 8 billion, which frankly made no sense to me. It was much more in the range of what the winning cities were offering. And it was based purely on a sense of the value that these jobs and this economic activity would bring to us was worth a modest investment helping to win that benefit for the residents of our region.
Bill Allen, the CEO of the LA Economic Development Corporation, also with us, economist Chris Thornburg, founding partner of Beacon Economics, and he directs UC Riverside's Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. Chris, your thoughts about Amazon bypassing LA for the two East Coast sites?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on, Larry. And look, at one level, I understand that it's nice that LA was selected as one of the 20 finalists. Now, I would argue that it really says a lot about where the LA economy is now. It's a substantially stronger, more dynamic place than it was 10, 15 years ago. And I think this is an acknowledgement of that. On the other hand, let's take a step back and let's think about where our local economy is. Los Angeles has a record number of payroll jobs in it. Los Angeles has a record number of employed residents. Unemployment in Los Angeles County has never been lower. Unemployment in San Bernardino and Riverside County has never been lower. The big problem here is we continue to talk about developing new jobs when, candidly, we don't have a labor force growth necessary to actually feed those new jobs with people. If this had come in at some level, again, big kudos, yes, high-paid jobs, a nice, if you will, sort of prestige project for LA, but without the housing, we weren't going to create a net number of new jobs. This was going to be 50,000 new jobs that were going to displace 50,000 other jobs. It was going to lead to more gentrification and more people having to leave. Right now, economic development in Southern California should be largely wrapped around one thing, and that's housing. If you build more housing, the economy will grow, as simple as that. And until that point in time, subsidizing the creation of new jobs is largely just moving decks around chairs around the deck of the Titanic, so to speak.
Bill Allen, you want to respond to that this would just be new jobs displacing current ones?
Yeah, I don't completely agree with that, although I do have a great deal of respect for Chris and understand the counterpoint that he's offering here. These were jobs, first of all, not coming in 50,000 or 25,000 all at one time. There is a lengthy rollout period for the hiring of these jobs. Again, I can't speak to the specifics of it because of the confidentiality, but I think Amazon has been pretty public that it's going to take at least 10 years to see all these jobs brought online. With a labor force of 5 million people here, I think bringing on 2,500 new job opportunities a year would not be particularly disruptive. Also, these are not 2,500 new tech workers coming to Los Angeles. They were interested in markets like Los Angeles and New York and Washington because of the substantial tech talent we have in the region. And they spent a good deal of time talking to our universities about their existing talent development pipelines and opportunities to augment those, helping us both better train our workforce to the specific needs they had in mind and bring other talented people here from around the world. And I think bringing creative talent here is a good thing. Creating more opportunities for our talent here is a good thing. But I completely agree with Chris that housing construction is essential for growing any sector of our economy.
Well, and Chris, so do you see this then as going to be a huge drag on Google and other big tech companies that would be looking to expand here in Los Angeles, that they're not going to be able to do it until there are more units of housing?
Well, no, because you got to remember that the companies you just talked about there pay their workers enough that they can basically outbid other folks. The Bay Area is a sort of classic case of what happens when you don't build enough housing. Tech continues to expand in the Bay Area, and it is largely displacing traditional older industries. We all like to think of the Bay Area as a big driver of growth in the California economy, but in terms of overall jobs created, it's a relatively small share despite all the hot presence of tech. So it really is a displacement effect. And, you know, candidly, I think we have to be cognizant of these labor shortage issues. Remember that even if it is a local talent that's hired by Amazon, that's still a local student that can't be hired by another company that's also trying to expand here in the L.A. region.
Economist Chris Thornburg, Beacon Economics, with us. Bill Allen, CEO of the L.A. Economic Development Corporation. Curious, Chris, do you think that with Amazon establishing the presence in New York City and in D.C., is that going to lead to other tech expansion in those markets?
Well, look, New York already has a tech industry. Northern Virginia already has a tech industry. It will obviously feed that particular growth. But, you know, I'm going to take a little bit of a step back, Larry, because when this first Amazon announcement was made, my first guess was Northern Virginia. And it really has nothing to do with airports and tech folks, although it certainly was something they were looking into. And it has everything to do with Jeff Bezos' obvious desire to, shall we say, engage in political conversations. His purchase of the Washington Post, his heavy emphasis on D.C. politics in that newspaper, it clearly shows where his ambitions are. And, you know, that takes me to a broader question, because in many ways, I almost feel like Jeff Bezos knew exactly where he wanted to be with these jobs. He wanted to be in Northern Virginia and New York. And really, this entire contest, if you will, was him about him mainly just getting those communities to hand him money to go someplace he probably would have gone to anyway.
Chris, thank you. I'm sorry I got to cut it short there, but appreciate you sharing your perspective on this. Chris Thornburg, Bill Allen, also with us, LA Economic Development Corporation. It's Air Talk on KPCC.